Welcome back to the History of Being Human podcast. I'm the host, Noel Armstrong. On this episode, we're going to be talking about the nuclear KGB Yeti alien bear on the Mountain of the Dead. Or, if you prefer a more down-to-earth name, the Dyatlov Pass mystery. This is an episode that is still hotly debated in Russia and frankly around the world, and continues to this very day to spawn numerous theories attempting to explain it. From the rational to the conspiratorial to the frankly supernatural, as my title indicates. In the elevator pitch format, the quick summary of this incident, this is what happened. Late January, early February 1959, which is now, of course, over 60 years ago. Fidel Castro is coming to power in Cuba, the Dalai Lama is escaping Tibet for India, and Russia remains the premier entity in the great Soviet Empire. A group of seasoned Russian explorers sets out on a cross-country hiking and skiing trek. These trekkers don't make their check-in, and in fact, they don't come back at all. Eventually, a grand search party is called, involving private citizens, police, search and rescue, even the Russian military gets involved. Almost a month after this group had set out, their tent is finally found. Eventually, their bodies are found also, and it's all part of a grisly scene that defies, initially at least, belief and comprehension, and still defies full explanation to this very day. The reason why it's so hard to explain fully should be obvious if you just consider a quick summary of the scene as it was eventually discovered by the search and rescue teams. The first thing they found somewhere above the tree line in a remote mountain, which the Mansi people there called the Mountain of the Dead or Dead Mountain, which I'll explain later, they found the trekker's tent. The tent itself was partly collapsed, partly buried in snow, but there was nobody inside. As they investigated, they found the tent had apparently been slashed open in several places from the inside. Inside was survival gear, neatly stacked firewood, boots, axes, a map, a bottle of vodka, and maybe weirdest of all, it looked like there was a freshly prepared dish of sala, which is white pork fat, which had been left uneaten. The first rescuers on the scene had high hopes that they would find the party alive because there was nobody dead in the tent, so they took the bottle of vodka and drank to the health of these hikers, these trekkers. Unfortunately, though, those hopes were soon dashed. As they looked around, about 100 feet downhill from the tent, the search party found footprints of about 8 or 9 people walking, not running, toward the tree line. Almost all of the prints seemed to indicate bare or stocking-clad feet. Almost none of them had shoes or boots, although one set of prints looked like the person had been wearing a ski boot on one foot and barefoot on the other. And the story just gets weirder after that. The day after finding the tent, they find 1,500 meters away in the tree line the bodies of 2 victims clad only in underwear. From broken branches on the tree and skin found embedded in the bark of the tree, it was obvious they had been trying to climb it. The bodies had burn marks, and one of the victims had bitten the flesh from his own right hand, and it remained in his mouth when they found the body. Later that same day, 2 other bodies were found, this time closer to the tent, in an attitude and position that looked like they had been trying to run back toward the tent. And it wasn't until months later that the remaining 5 bodies would be found. Among the victims, autopsies and investigations would reveal the following fairly macabre list. 2 sets of broken or crushed ribs, 1 crushed skull, 1 slightly cracked skull, 1 missing tongue, 4 missing eyes, 2 missing eyebrows, 4 clothing items with high levels of radiation on them, and, as they would later determine, 0 signs of violent interpersonal struggle. So on the surface level, what is now known as the Dyatlov Pass incident seems, if tragic, at least comprehensible. I mean, where's the mystery? 9 ski hikers die in sub-zero conditions in extremely difficult terrain. But it's the details. It's the condition of the scene, trauma the body sustained, the way they apparently cut their way out of their tent and ran headlong to their deaths in extremely harsh, prohibitively dangerous conditions, and then never made their way back to the tent, even though it was just a few hundred yards away. That's why the Dyatlov Pass incident remains a mystery, sparking interest, conspiracy theories, and, of course, podcasts, to this very day. We Deep in the Ural Mountains of Russia, there's a peak which was known on Soviet maps only as Peak 1079. To the native Mansi people, though, it was Holat Siakal, a name which essentially means dead mountain, or mountain of no life. Now, before you think that that sounds too ominous, let me just say that, to the Mansi, what that really means is, don't go hunting there. It is a mountain devoid of game, devoid of life worth hunting. It is not, I repeat, it is not because the Mansi think that it is a place where you are going to die, or that it houses the spirits of the dead. In fact, if you look at the many online pictures, you'll be struck by two facts, I think. Fact one is that the mountain is apparently pretty lifeless. There's not much game there, and you can see why there's not much foliage. The other fact that you'll be struck with is that calling it the Mountain of the Dead is pretty big talk with pretty small capital. It's not much of a mountain at all. It's better described as a hill or a mound. And the reason that it was called Peak 1079 on Soviet maps is because it was about 3,500 feet high. So while we have to admit that's a pretty respectable ascent on a mountain bike, it's not the tallest mountain in the world. The area is now called Dyatlov Pass because Igor Dyatlov was the leader of that group of ill-fated ski hikers who died on that mountain in 1959. And here at the beginning of the episode, I want to take just a moment to introduce you to these trekkers, because none of them were inexperienced rubes. All of them had some experience, and they were all in good physical condition. Young, healthy, and experienced trekkers. We'll begin with Igor Dyatlov himself. Igor was a student at the Ural Polytechnic Institute. That was one of the top-flight engineering universities in the Soviet Union, turning out top-tier engineers to work in the nuclear industries, military engineering, communications, and Dyatlov was one of those. During his years at that university, Dyatlov led several treks. Some of them were very arduous. In fact, he seemed to enjoy the more difficult treks. And in late 1958, he began to plan a winter expedition that would be the most arduous yet. So he typed up a proposal, an itinerary, and he presented it to the Ural Polytechnic Institute Sports Club. 16 days across the Ural Mountains in the middle of winter, in harsh conditions. The sports club readily approved the itinerary, trusting Dyatlov's experience. The trip that he planned lay 350 miles north of Sverdlovsk, where the Polytechnic Institute was located. It was a very remote location, mainly inhabited by the Mansi people. Now, the Mansi were indigenous people, but they'd been in contact, they'd been Russified for over 300 years by that time. But they chose to continue with their cultural identity, so they enjoyed hunting, fishing, reindeer herding, living still in a semi-indigenous way. And the route that Dyatlov proposed went 200 miles through that Mansi territory, on a route that, as far as anyone knew, no Russians had ever been through before. It wasn't that the terrain was particularly rugged. It was somewhat rolling hills and forests. The problem would be the brutally cold conditions of the winter, where temperatures went routinely below 35 degrees Celsius, and also the difficulty getting in and out of the location. It was very remote. But like I said, people trusted Dyatlov. In fact, he was a natural leader, even though he was only 23 at the time of this expedition. He had a reputation for being very thorough, very even-keeled, and in excellent physical condition. And I'll give you just one little vignette from Dyatlov's life. Once when he was the leader of a different expedition, one of the members of the expedition had stolen a can of condensed milk from his backpack and drank it. Later this participant felt guilty about drinking the milk and came and confessed to Dyatlov, fully expecting to get thrown out of the team, screamed at, or some kind of repercussion. But according to this trekker, that was not Dyatlov's leadership style. Instead, he said Dyatlov, quote, did not scold or shame. He kept silent. And then he said, we will return to Sverdlovsk. You will pay the cost of the condensed milk to the group's cash desk. That was all he said. According to this hiker, he remembered that for many years as a great example of leadership. So that was Igor Dyatlov. Next we have Yuri Doroshenko. He was the fourth-year student, tallest in the group, 21 years old at the time of his death. We know a few things about Yuri. One is that he had a very impulsive personality. In fact, on a previous expedition, a bear had approached the camp, and he had only had a geology hammer in his hand, and he went after the bear. So that's pretty legit, chasing off a bear with a geology hammer. He also had had a relationship at one time with another member of the group named Zina, which we will get to. By the time the Dyatlov expedition was undertaken, he had broken off that relationship with her. Now, I know what you're thinking, but I'm just going to put it to bed right now. There was no motivation for murder from this relationship. They were friends after they broke up. She may still have had feelings for Yuri, but they were friends. They got along just fine. And the other thing we know about Yuri Doroshenko is he was probably from the poorest family of any of the students on the expedition. So poor, in fact, that his clothing was considered barely adequate for the cold conditions they would face. Next, we will come to Liuda Dubinina. She was the youngest member of the group, only 20 years old. In fact, she was buried on her 21st birthday, May 12, 1959. A fourth-year student, engineering major, also minoring in economics, and an athlete, a runner. What's interesting about her is something seems to have gone horribly wrong with her temperament around the time of the incident. Part of the way into the journey, she started to be very sour. She started to write things in her journal like, "This is evil as hell. The mood is bad. In general, I am very, very sad." She refused to help with tent repairs. So something was going on with Liuda that we don't know. According to one account of the expedition, quote, "The only plausible explanation for dramatic changes in Lyudmila's behavior can be her premonition of impending mortal threat," end quote. So, in other words, the only rational explanation for why she was in a bad mood is that she had a supernatural premonition that she was going to die. And, I mean, who knows? But I would submit there's probably a more pedestrian explanation. We just don't know what it was. She was in a terrible mood the last few days before the tragedy. Next, we come to Alexander Kolevatov. He had a very complicated and interesting childhood, but one also marked by tragedy. His father had a very good position when Alexander was a young boy. They were rich. They lived in the center of town. And then a purge came, and his father was moved to a gulag. Luckily, it was not as a prisoner. He was moved there as a director at the gulag. So Alexander was raised part of his young life among prisoners at a gulag. During World War II, German soldiers were kept in that gulag, and it was one of the worst. So we can assume that young Alexander was exposed to scenes of horrific brutality. We don't know that, but we can assume it. But things became much worse for Alexander's family when his father was found dead on the railway tracks, having been struck by a train. No investigation was ever launched into his father's death. And this was a time of secrecy around these matters. So no explanation was given, but what did that mean for the family? They lost everything. They had to survive on food stamps, what were called food coupons. What that meant was every member of the family got 200 grams of bread per day, 3 pounds of fish per month, and about 3 pounds of grain per month per person. So in other words, they were all starving. And at this time, Alexander was only 10 years old. So he lived through some very lean years and actually became somewhat of a sickly child. Did not excel in school, but did well enough to at least make it into college. Then, during his third year of college, something changed. He began to excel in nuclear physics, so much so that he was heavily recruited by the various factions in the party. And if he hadn't died in the Dyatlov Pass incident, he could have written his own ticket. Well as anyone in the Soviet Union at the time could write their own ticket. So that's just a little about Alexander Kolevatov. Next we come to Zinaida Kolmogorova. That's the only time I will try that last name. We will just call her Zina, as everyone did at the time. Zina was 22 years old at the time of her death. She was a fifth-year student studying radio engineering. She was apparently a very warm person, very outgoing, very social. She was loved by everyone, it said, especially by children. I spoke about the fact that she had been in a fairly serious relationship with Yuri Doroshenko, had taken him home to meet her parents, but that had been broken up by Yuri, apparently, before this expedition. She was constantly seen around this time in the company of Igor Dyatlov. This led to some speculation about a romantic relationship, but it does not seem that that's the case, and we'll get to why later. But essentially a very affable, social, and apparently a very kind person. That was Zina. She had been on 6 expeditions prior to this one. Any time Igor Dyatlov arranged an expedition, Zina was the first to sign up. She was also, despite her affability, a very tough and determined person. In fact, on one of the expeditions, she was bitten by a poisonous snake, by a viper. She hiked all the way back, refusing to let other people help carry her load, despite her own pain and suffering, which must have been pretty severe, being bitten by a viper. She said she didn't want to be a hardship to others. So that was Zina. According to her friend, Yuri Yudin, quote, "Everywhere she went, she filled the place with the pleasant breath of her soul," end quote. So I guess that Xena was kind of the Betty to Liuta's Veronica on this trip. Next, we come to Yuri Krivonoshenko, affectionately known as Georgi, or Georgi as we'll call him. Georgi was kind of the jester, the clown, the musician, the entertainer of the group. He was one of Dyatlov's closest friends, but he did have a knack for getting into a little bit of trouble. In fact, he was detained by police in the early part of their journey because he had been pretty boisterous on the train, singing, playing his mandolin. And when they arrived in the town of Sirov, he asked Liuta for some money. She was the group's treasurer. He asked her for some money to get some breakfast, and she said, no, we don't have enough money. So he began singing with his mandolin very loudly, walking around holding his hat and asking for money. According to Liuta's diary about the event, quote, they, the police, immediately took him to the police station. The policeman told him singing in public places is forbidden. This was the first public place where it is forbidden to sing, end quote. So while this was a pretty inauspicious start to Georgie's expedition, if he would have been kept at the police station, it would have saved his life. But after a little bit of bluster, a little bit of threatening, the police actually released him, warning him not to sing or panhandle again. The song that you're hearing play while we talk about Georgie is the song I Love You Life, recorded by the Soviet Sinatra himself, Mark Burns. This was Georgie's favorite song. And as his mother would say later, it defined his whole approach to the world. He loved his friends, and he loved his life. Despite this very happy-go-lucky persona and his apparent close friendship with Dyatlov himself, Yuri Krivonoshenko, Georgi, remains a little bit of a mysterious person. It is known that he worked at the Mayak secret nuclear facility in the Soviet Union. During his time there, there was actually a reactor meltdown. There was talk of high levels of radiation on his clothes, even at the time of the tragedy. And as I read the description and the accounts from Russian authors, many of them seem to think that Georgi was a KGB agent. When you read the journal entries and the letters written by Georgi, though, this seems, again, very far-fetched to me. Let me read you a letter he wrote to Dyatlov. 1 month before the expedition, while it was still in the planning stages, he wrote the following poem. Hello everyone, happy new year, hiking friends. Let me wish you camping in faraway mountains, ascending summits in the wild. Let your backpacks be light, weather always fine, winter not too cold, and summer to be mild. The dirt not to bother you, the sugar not to get wet. When the river is boiling and you go overboard, pants not to shred into tatters, so you can patch them and go after drying your jacket at night, to have left more than a sleeve. Your shoes to be good, not a year, but dozens of years. Wish you to leave your tracks all over the map of Russia. He then speaks about how excited he is for the trip, how he is getting a physical before he leaves, and asks where he should send his money to. So I will just say, far from getting a sinister vibe from Georgi, I get the impression of a jug-eared, happy-go-lucky, mandolin-playing somewhat theatrical class clown. Next we come to Rustem Slobodin. Rustem, or Rustic as he was called, was a 23-year-old graduate, so he'd already graduated, finished his schooling by the time he went on this expedition. From what we know of Rustic, he was raised in Asian countries, and his parents gave him a name, Rustem, which is considered Asian, even though he was an ethnic Russian. Despite being quiet and soft-spoken, he was considered an excellent athlete. At one time, he and his father had wanted to go visit Rustic's older brother. So they hiked over 300 kilometers through hostile territory in the Tian Shan Mountains. It was considered a feat of pure hubris, and they made it. They came out of it just fine. So Rustic was known as an athlete, quiet. I don't know much more about him. Next we come to Nikolai Thibault Brignol. He was known as Thibault. He was a recent graduate of the UPI. He was working in construction at the time of the expedition. According to contemporary accounts, everyone who knew Thibault noted his energy, inventiveness, friendliness, good humor. He was very popular among students at the UPI. And like so many other students on this expedition and throughout the area, he was born into a tragic circumstance. His father was interred at a concentration camp at the time Thibault was born. We next come to the member of the group that was the oldest, the most mysterious, and the source for most of the conspiracy theories about possible military, government, or KGB involvement in the deaths of the group. I am speaking of Semyon Zolotaryov, who will be known hereafter as Sasha. Sasha was definitely a demographic outlier in this group. He was a veteran of World War II. In fact, he'd served the entire time between 1941 and 1946 in the Soviet Army, during some of the most brutal and fatal campaigns of the war, during a time when they endured almost unimaginable levels of hardship. Sasha was much older than the other members of the group, and he was added to the expedition near the very end. That's what gives rise to some of the conspiracy theories. Nearly all of the group members are in their early 20s. Sasha was 38 years old. Unknown to many of the members of the group at the time, he also had a newborn son, which he named Sasha. I don't have time to get into the speculation around this person's identity. Suffice it to say that he was working as a physical education instructor around the time of the trip, and it makes perfect sense that he would want to join this kind of an expedition. That, and the fact that he ended up just as dead as every other member of the group, makes me think he was there to go on a skiing hiking expedition. Not to spy on, not to sabotage, not to kill them if they came too close to secret military installations, which have all been hypothesized. So I won't dwell on the conspiracy theories around Semyon, or about who is buried in Semyon's grave, but you can look all of that up. That concludes the list of fatalities in the Dyatlov Pass incident. I'm going to mention one more person, a man named Yuri Yudin. He's the only survivor from that group, and it's only because of a case of severe sciatica. That's right, Yuri was one of the leaders of the group, one of the most energetic, beloved members of the group. There's a rumor that he was actually in love with and loved by Liuda. In fact, when he left to go back, she was distraught. Some people think that her sour temper, her bitter mood during the trip, was because she was missing Yuri. This and the fact that Yuri felt tremendous guilt his entire life over not going with the expedition, and he never married, has led to some speculation about their relationship. On the day that Yuri left to go back home, Liuda made the following entry in her diary, quote, "Yurka Yudin is going back home today. It is a pity, of course, to part with him, especially for Zina and me, but we can't do anything about it," end quote. Yuri died in 2013. Until the end of his life, he kept a teddy bear that Liuda had given him. And it's also apparent that he had a crushing case of survivor's guilt because every year on the anniversary of their deaths, he went to the graveyard and with tears in his eyes said, "I'm sorry, my friends, I should have been with you." Two interesting facts about Yuri. Before he died, he denied there was a romantic relationship between him and Liuda. But many people don't believe his denial. I won't go into why. And the other fact is, he does not believe that his friends succumbed to the weather or to an avalanche or any other natural cause. He believes they came too close to a secret military testing ground and were killed, and that the scene was a setup. It was designed to make it look like they had succumbed to an avalanche or hypothermia. And while his opinion does have some weight, it may just be one more conspiracy theory added to the mix. We'll see what you think when we complete our story. So I know that's been a rather lengthy introduction to the various members of this party, but in almost all histories of this event I've come across, they simply name people as the victim, or they will name one or two of them and tell you nothing about them. For some reason, I felt very compelled by looking through their photos and looking at their life histories. Frankly, I think you could say I went down a rabbit hole. Because online you can find their journals. Their journals exist, they've been translated, you can read them online. And what to me was even more affecting, the film from their cameras has been developed, and you can see all of those images online as well. If I can remember when I get to the end of this recording, which I sometimes don't, I will post a link online where you can view the images and read some of the journal entries if you're interested. But now let's go through the timeline, cover the events that led to the deaths of the group members. As I already indicated when talking about their biographies, the fall and early winter of 1958 were spent planning the expedition. The expedition proper got underway in late January 1959. January 23rd, they board a train in Sverdlovsk. They travel through the night, arriving the next morning 350 kilometers north in the town of Serov. It's that town of Serov where Yuri Krivonoshenko, the one I was calling Georgie, had that unfortunate episode where he was detained by the Duer Soviet policeman, with the primary charges being public singing and also panhandling. He was later released, and the group was able to board a train in Serov. And on the next day, January 25th, they arrive in the even more remote Ural Mountain town of Ivdel. That same day, January 25th, they board a bus which takes them to Vizhe. And of course, as you can guess, every step along the way, they're getting farther and farther from civilization, more and more remote. In fact, the next ride they catch from Vizhe is in the back of a truck. It looks like they just bummed a ride off of the driver. That truck takes them from Vizhe to a town with the perfect steampunk name of District 41. It's nothing more than a small logging camp. and it's there from District 41. On January 27, that this group of 10 skiers hires a horse-drawn sled to carry their gear 24 kilometers from District 41 to a remote labor camp, probably a forced labor camp considering the era we're in, called North 2. They ski to North 2. The horse-drawn carriage carries their gear. They arrive there on the 28th of January, and it's then that Yuri Yudin realizes he can't make this trip. Just skiing those 24 kilometers had wrecked his back, and his sciatica was killing him. He decided he had to turn back and take a sled ride back to civilization. So there at the North 2 labor camp, Yuri Yudin says goodbye to his friends. The goodbye seems cheerful when you look at the photographs, but when you read the journals of the group members, they were sad to see him go. And it's all the more poignant when you look at the photographs of those goodbyes, because you realize he's never going to see his friends again. Yuri Yudin is going to be haunted by the shame, the sadness, and the guilt of that farewell for the rest of his life. For the next couple of days, the group does what they came to do. They ski and they camp. They follow their planned route, and they camp mostly along the shores of the Auspia River initially. But they complain that the weather is getting bitter cold. The journal entry from January 30th reads this, quote, "Today's the third cold night on the shore of the Auspia River. The stove does a great job. Some, Thibaut and Krivonoshenko, think we need to construct a heating system in the tent. Having curtains hung in the tent is quite justified. We get up at 8:30 a.m. After breakfast, we walk along the Auspia River. But again, these ice dams don't allow us to move forward." End quote. So, as you can guess, the weather was getting cold, and their movements were obstructed somewhat by frozen rivers. The next day, January 31st, they wanted to get from one river to another, the Auspia to the Lozva. The shortest route between those two rivers ascended what is now called Dyatlov Pass. This is what the group journal for January 31st says. Quote, "We're gradually leaving the Auspia. The ascent is continuous, but rather smooth. We passed fir trees and found ourselves in a rare birch forest. Then we reached the forest edge. The wind is westerly, warm, and blistering with the same impression of airspeed as when a plane is taking off." So you get the idea. Very fast wind. Going on, "There is ice crust everywhere around us. The making of a storage depot is not feasible at all. It's about 4 p.m. We need to find somewhere suitable to camp for the night. We're going down to the Auspia Valley. It seems to be the snowiest place here. The wind is slack. The snow is 1.22 meters deep. Tired and exhausted, we started to prepare the place for the overnight stop. We lacked firewood, which consisted mostly of weak, wet fir trees. We made a fire on logs. No one wanted to dig a special hole for it. We had dinner right in the tent. It's warm in here. It's difficult to imagine such comfort somewhere on a mountain range with the severe howl of the wind hundreds of kilometers from any inhabited places." End quote. I think that journal entry gives you a pretty good idea of what they were going through. They were cold, the wind was bitter in the higher elevations. They lacked firewood of an adequate quality and supply, but in general their spirits were up. Inside the tent, they were keeping warm. And that despite recorded temperatures at that time in that area between negative 15 and negative 25 degrees Celsius. On that night of January 31st, they made plans for the next day, which would be February 1st. The next big event, the next big obstacle, if you will, in their trek, was to ascend and then descend over Dyatlov Pass on their way to Mount Otorten. It was decided by Dyatlov and others that they would go back to the Auspia River that night, as we said, for a warm, sheltered campsite. They would make a storage and they would leave the extra load there. There was no use bringing all their firewood and all of their gear over the pass. So they would spend a cold night on Dyatlov Pass. They would sleep in the tent in their warm gear without fire. And that would be the night of the 1st of February. The next day, the 2nd of February, was going to be a big day, the biggest day, the day they had planned for. On that day, the group was supposed to cover 14 to 15 kilometers over a firm, dense snow that would be a fairly easy traverse, even though the distance was quite long. They hadn't brought firewood, but they did bring a stove to their cold camp for the night of February 1st. February 2nd, the intention, it seems, was to go to a lake in the region where they could spend a much warmer overnight, because they wrote about how temperatures near the lake would be much warmer. Now, I say it seems that was their intention because nobody knows. Nothing more was heard from the group. Nothing more has been found documenting their movements. And in hindsight, we know that on February 2nd, 1959, all members of the Dyatlov group died in a mysterious way. On the 12th of February, they were supposed to check in back in Vizhe. They didn't show up. Of course, nobody was overly concerned. It's not unexpected for a group to be a day or two late with their check-in. But a few days after that, people are, of course, starting to get very nervous. Something bad has happened. By February 21st, the first search parties are on the way. And of course, with each passing day, people become more nervous. They're not looking to rescue. They're looking for a recovery operation at that point. By February 26th, 24 days after the group was supposed to check back in at Vigée, the tent is found. It's partially buried in snow, but there's something concerning about the condition of the tent. It appears that there are several slashes through the side of the tent, the downhill side of the tent. The next day, the 27th, 1,500 meters away down the hill, the bodies of Yuri Krivonoshenko and Yuri Doroshenko, in other words, Big Yuri and Georgie, were found lying face down in the snow. Later that same day, 300 yards up the slope from where the two Yuris were found, a Mansi search party finds the body of Igor Dyatlov, the group's leader. That same day, a rescue dog finds the body of Zina, another 400 yards or so up the slope from Dyatlov. All of them are downhill from the tent, all of them lying in exposed snow but buried by that snow somewhat. Shortly after that, between the bodies of Zina and Igor Dyatlov, the body of Rustic, Rustem Slobodin, the one who had traversed across the Tian Shan Mountains with his father to visit his brother, was found again lying face down in the snow. The remains of the remaining four hikers would remain a mystery for over 2 months until a grisly find on May 5, 1959, would reveal a den located by then in a creek some 1,500 meters away from the tent downhill, in which were the bodies of Lyuda Dubinina, Nikolai Thibault, Semyon Zolotaryov, and Alexander Kolevatov. And so really it wasn't until the spring thaw that all nine bodies were finally accounted for. Now, much of the macabre mystery about what happened to the Dyatlov group centers around the condition of the bodies as they were found. So let's cover that. As I said, the bodies of the two Yuris were found first, Georgie and Big Yuri. Their bodies were found lying under a large cedar tree. The cedar tree had branches broken at a height of 4 to 5 meters, so it was apparent that somebody had tried to scale the tree. Both bodies were dressed only in a shirt and a pair of underwear. Neither was wearing pants, and neither had socks or shoes on. Big Yuri had burns on his left leg and his right temple. Krivonoshenko Georgie had burns on his left leg and left foot. On their hands were numerous minor injuries, bruises, and abrasions, probably from attempting to climb a tree. The bodies were arranged. They were laid down right next to each other. Now, when somebody dies, if they're lying on their back, blood settles in their back. They call that the liver mortis. Doroshenko had evidence of blood settling in his back, that he had been on his back when he died. But when they found his body, he was turned face down. Somebody had moved his body after his death. So those were the first two bodies found, the bodies by the old cedar. And despite the small burn wounds on their body and the injuries to their hands, the cause of death is officially hypothermia. Slightly up the slope from their bodies was the body of Igor Dyatlov, next found. He was very lightly dressed. He had no shoes. He was wearing a knitted vest and a jacket, but these were unbuttoned. That's considered very unusual for somebody dying of hypothermia. He had a few minor injuries that you would expect, but the cause of death, again, was hypothermia. Next was the body of Zina. She was much better dressed than many of the other corpses. Maybe that is a nod to the chivalry of the group. But maybe she just outlived many of the other members. Women often outlast men in these extreme survival situations. Zina might have lived long enough to borrow clothing items from other members of the group. We just don't know. There was a laceration, an injury on her right tibia. But according to photos from the trip, it's obvious that she was injured somewhere along the way, not after her death, not immediately around the time of her death. And the knuckles, those knuckles on her right hand, were bruised. But despite these minor injuries, there was no internal damage. The cause of death, again for Zina, was hypothermia. Next, we come to the body of Rustic, Rustem. Rustem's body was found 480 meters from the cedar toward the tent, and he, like Zina, was also much better dressed than many of the other hikers. In fact, he had a long-sleeve undershirt, a shirt, a sweater, two pairs of pants, four pairs of socks, one felt boot on his right foot. His watch was stopped at 8:45 a.m. Of course, I can't figure out what relevance that has. It's interesting, but we don't know if that was the day of his death or sometime before or after. The picture gets a little clouded with Rustic. the cause of death is officially hypothermia, and yet he had a fracture of the frontal bone of his skull, and that fracture was sustained apparently while Rustic was still alive. The thought was he became hypothermic, disoriented, and fell. And I guess I have to admit that's possible, but how many times do you hear of people falling so hard in the snow that they fracture their skull? And Rustic's case gets even stranger because the temporalis muscle, so that's the muscle over your temple on the sides of your skull, on both sides of Rustic's head, his temporalis muscle had hemorrhages. So something hit his frontal lobe hard, or it hit something hard. And something also hit both sides of his skull near the temporalis muscles hard enough to deeply contuse those muscles. And again, you don't get muscle contusions. You don't bleed into a contused area of muscle if your heart has already stopped beating. So again, the autopsy report was very cautious with Rustic. They said he probably became disoriented and bumped his head, or he fell hard, bumped his head, and that hastened his demise from hypothermia. The official cause of death was still hypothermia. And it's hard to figure out how to factor that head trauma into that picture. So now we need to talk about the four bodies found in the den, the famous, the mysterious den of Dyatlov Pass. As I said earlier, the remaining four bodies of the Dyatlov Pass group were not found for 2 more months after the initial 5 had been found. What happened is in May the snow started melting, and a Mansi man named Kurikov and his dog followed some cut branches that they noticed along the trail about 50 meters from the cedar tree. There they uncovered a sweater and some other clothing, and soon the remaining 4 bodies were found. And these would be the other young woman in the group, Lyuda, Semyon Zolotaryov, the one who had been in the army and was older than the rest of the students involved, and Kolevatov and Thibault. These 4 members of the party had had enough wherewithal, enough sanity, if you will, and enough time and energy to actually construct to dig a den to try to survive the cold. Many think it was the war veteran Semyon's idea, because that was a common way to survive very cold nights along the front. And some effort had gone into preparing this den. They had cut branches from cedar trees and laid them on the ground, dug out an area of the snow so that they could huddle together and stay warm. The clothing that the members of the group in the den were wearing also answered one possible paradox. There is this concept of paradoxical undressing. I talked about it when we were talking about the Donner Party, how when you're in the last stages of hypothermia, you may actually start to feel hot, take off your clothes, and hasten your own demise. Well, after the initial bodies were found on the slope side, and it was noticed that many of them were not wearing clothes, there was some thought that they had done this, that they had paradoxically undressed in the last stages of hypothermia. Well, this turned out not to be the case, because on the people in the den were some of the clothing items from those who had died on the slope. So, for example, Lyuda, the female, her body was found in the den wearing the pants and sweater of Krivonoshenko, whose body had been found almost 2 months earlier, almost completely undressed. So it is apparent, and also a little terrifying, that many members of the group saw their friends die and then borrowed their clothing from them so that they themselves could attempt to survive. And it's frankly amazing how quickly their situation went from fairly controlled and planned to extreme and desperate. It's not like the slow starvation of the Donner Pass party. These are people who, a day or two earlier, had food supplies, were having fun on a recreational ski trip, and all of a sudden, something dramatically and irrevocably changed their situation. Now, as I said, the den itself is evidence that some of the group still had the presence of mind to attempt to survive. But the condition of the bodies in the den is another mystery. What happened to these 4 bodies in the den? And I'll tell you exactly what I mean. But suffice it to say for now, you can't explain the level of massive trauma sustained by these bodies in the den by simply saying that a snow den collapsed on top of them. Why is that? Well, only one of the 4 bodies in the den did not have massive bone-fracturing levels of trauma. That was Kolevatov, the nuclear physicist everyone called Sasha. He had some exposed skull bones, but he died from hypothermia, and it's thought that the skull bones were exposed through natural processes. Lyuda, Semyon, and Thibault suffered levels of trauma that the coroner compared to a high-speed automobile impact. Liuta had several major chest fractures. She had a flail chest. She was missing her tongue, her eyes, part of her lips. Facial tissue was gone and a fragment of her skull bone. Semyon's the army veteran. Major chest fractures, missing eyeballs. Thibaut had multiple skull fractures, hemorrhages, and bruises in his soft tissue. I will read you an excerpt from the interrogation of the forensic expert that reviewed the damage to these bodies back in 1959. So this is the pathologist who evaluated the bodies, who did a lot of the original autopsies. Question is put to him, quote, "How is it possible to explain the cause of the damage to Dubonina and Zolotarov? Is it possible to combine them into one cause?" And the response of this expert, of course, translated from Russian, is this. On Dubonina, the injuries were bilateral and symmetrical on both sides, in other words. And on Zolotaryov, they were one-sided. Both had hemorrhaging into the cardiac muscles, with hemorrhaging into the pleural cavity, which is evidence of them being alive when the injuries were sustained. So if they had already been dead, they would not have bled into their cardiac tissue and pleural cavities. The expert then goes on. It is the result of a large force, just as in the example of Thibaut. These wounds, especially appearing in such a way, without any damage to the soft tissue of the chest, are very similar to the type of trauma that results from the shock wave of a bomb. So catch what he's saying. There was no damage to the skin and muscle over the chest, but the ribs were crushed. So the force was of such a type that it was absorbed by the bones but didn't damage the chest muscle or skin. Now, another question was subsequently put to this expert. He was asked, how long could Dubonina and Zolotaryov have lived after this massive trauma they sustained? This is what the expert said, quote, Dubonina died 10 to 20 minutes after the trauma. She could have been conscious. Sometimes it happens when a person with a wound to the heart, for example, a serious knife wound, can talk, run, and ask for help. Dubonina's situation was one of complicated traumatic shock resulting from the bilateral rib fracture, with subsequent internal hemorrhaging into the pleural cavity. Zolotaryov could have lived longer. It needs to be taken into account that they were all trained, physically fit, and strong people. So that is certainly a very bleak and heartbreaking picture of their final minutes. Something crushed their skull, gave them flail chest. They bled into the pleural cavity and hearts. Dubonina's injuries were so severe she probably lived for 10 or 20 minutes afterward, and Semyon may have lived on a little longer. The cause of death was not hypothermia. It was massive trauma. So you can certainly see why this den and the condition of the bodies in this den gave rise to most of the mysteries, the conspiracy theories, the unanswered questions around the deaths of the Dyatlov group. Let's finish now with Thibaut. We said earlier that Thibaut had multiple skull fractures. The forensic expert was asked about the nature of these skull fractures, and this is what he said. Quote, in the conclusion, it's shown the damage to Thibaut's head could have been the result of the throwing fall or jettisoning of the body. I don't believe these injuries could have been the result of Thibaut simply falling from the level of his own height. For example, falling and hitting his head. The extensive, depressed, multi-splintered, broken fornix and base of the skull fracture could be the result of an impact of an automobile moving at high speed. This kind of trauma could have occurred if Thibaut had been thrown and fallen and hit his head against rocks, ice, etc. by a gust of strong wind. End quote. The forensic expert is then asked, is it possible that Thibaut was hit by a rock that was in someone's hand? He says, no, in this case, there would have been damage to an area of soft tissue, and this was not evident. Finally, they ask the expert, how long could Thibaut have lived after the trauma? Could he have moved on his own, talked, etc.? And this is what the expert says, quote, after this trauma, Thibaut would have had a severe concussion. That is, he would have been in an unconscious state. Moving him would have been difficult, and close to the end, movement would not have been possible for him. I believe he would not have been able to move, even if he had been helped. He only could have been carried or dragged. He could have shown signs of life for 2 to 3 hours. So, as you can tell, so many questions arise when you look at the scene on this mountain of horrors. How did Thibaut get into the den after his skull had been crushed? Who helped him? Obviously, group members must have carried him, but they had suffered their own trauma. There are so many mysteries that people bring up. Where and how could Thibaut have fallen from such a height? Did he try to climb the tree? Was he looking for other members of the group? Had he fallen off a cliff or a ledge? And if so, where? Was the trauma that caused Tebow's death the same massive force that caused the deaths of Semyon and Liuda? And speaking of Semyon and Liuda, how had they ended up in the den after sustaining such massive force to their chest cavities and to their skulls? Did whatever happened to them happen in the den, or were they brought into the den after it occurred? Was Tebow still alive at that time and helped bring them back into the den? Or had a massive force, the force equivalent to an explosion, according to the coroner, somehow caused the injuries to the members of the group who were all sheltering in the den together? There are just so many mysteries associated with this. What were the two bodies found under the cedar tree doing? Why did they climb it? Were they looking for other members of the group? Were they looking for their storage stash of firewood? How had they become so disoriented, if so? Why were the bodies of Dyatlov and others found apparently trying to make their way back to the tent? What had stopped them from making it that short distance? Did they simply freeze to death? Were they at their last extreme? Were they traveling together toward the tent and simply died off one by one? I have to admit, it's not impossible to explain people becoming disoriented in a bad storm and freezing to death. But there are mysteries. Aside from the obvious great mystery of what happened to the bodies in the den, what traumatic force killed them? What happened to the knife that they used to cut branches to line the floor of the den? That knife has never been found. But the great mystery looming over all of this is what went wrong in the first place? Why did they get out of the tent? Why did they walk, not run, through the snow? Why was the tent hastily slashed from the inside so that they could escape out the downhill side? Was the entrance occluded by snow? Did they hear something coming like an avalanche and run for their lives? Was there something that entered the tent, whether a bear or wolverine? This seems much less likely, I guess. But did they have to run from something else? How did they become separated after this? How did they end up in such different areas, in different conditions? And why did the people in the den not go back to the tent to get the gear and supplies that were still there? Were they that disoriented, that lost? Was the tent so buried that they couldn't find it? What happened on Dyatlov Pass in 1959 remains in many ways a mystery to this very day. If you followed the story at all, you know that most people explain the events, at least the beginning of the events, by an avalanche. What kind of avalanche? What caused it? Those are points of contention. But an avalanche is thought to be the inciting event. I have to admit I have no clear solution to the scenario that we are presented with when we look over the evidence at the scene. On the next episode, I want to present some of the whys and wherefores about the avalanche theory. I'll also try to cover some of the ways people have tried to explain the other mysteries about the Dyatlov group. I don't know yet. I might try to throw my hat in the ring and offer my own theory with, of course, confident assurance. The confidence of ignorance, which I have plenty of. But I do find the story fascinating. Thank you for listening. This is the History of Being Human podcast. I'm the host, Noel Armstrong. Again, please feel free to contact me, thobhpodcast, that's thobhpodcast@gmail.com. Those of you who have written know I try to take the time to get back to you. Not always promptly, but I answer every email. The idea for this episode was provided by a listener. Thank you, Peyton. It is a fascinating topic. I'm glad I took it up. I have a little work to do, and I'll get back to it next time.